It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. On Thursday, a committee of farmers, conservationists, and lawmakers met to discuss Wisconsin's once-threatened population of sandhill cranes and future management plans for the bird species.
The Joint Legislative Council's Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes is made up of 12 members. Their mission? Study crane management strategies and eventually recommend legislation that will address the bird's impact on Wisconsin farms.
A proposal in the legislature in 2021 would have created a sandhill crane hunting season in our state, but it didn't advance in the legislature.
Two committee members join us now representing conservation and agriculture interests. Rick Gerke is a farmer and board member of the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association. Rick, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And Ann Lacey is the International Crane Foundation's Director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America. And welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Ann, can you start us with a little bit of the history, the fall and rise of sandhill crane populations in Wisconsin and this eastern flyway?
I can. I think Aldo Leopold said it best. Famously, the Leopold Shack is right down the road from us here at the International Crane Foundation. And he wrote an elegy to this bird that he thought was going to die out in his lifetime. Well, he didn't get to see that, but he also didn't get to see the amazing comeback of that bird. So in the early 1900s, they were nearly extirpated from the upper Midwest. But the breeding concentration was still in Wisconsin. There was about 25 breeding pairs. And from that, we have the comeback of this species in the upper Midwest that we see today, over 100,000 birds now in this population, which sounds like a lot, but in terms of birds, 100,000 isn't that many. But they're a big bird. So when you see a lot of them, it really makes an impression.
And Rick, one of the concerns, part of the reason this committee exists in the first place, is concern about sandhill cranes in the higher numbers now having an impact on agriculture. What kind of things are you seeing and hearing from fellow farmers?
You know, obviously in the farming or agricultural sector, you know, as they start migrating through, you know, they are affecting our stands, you know, eating our crops, and, you know, essentially just cutting down on our bottom line, essentially costing us thousands of dollars every year. And really, really looking forward to finding an answer to what we can do with them.
And Rick, is there a particular time in the growing calendar when sandhill cranes you're seeing affecting corn and other crops?
You know, in the springtime, as they're migrating through, they're definitely affecting the corn crop, most definitely. You know, speaking as part of the Wisconsin corn growers, but as a farmer, you know, we have troubles with them also in the fall, you know, with our winter wheat crop as well.
And I know the Crane Foundation works with people in places around the world trying to find a balance between protecting cranes and protecting human economic interests. Do you have solutions, approaches that you could see taking to kind of to balance concerns about corn and other crops and cranes?
We do. And in each place, it is a different situation. Cranes are different. The crops are different. And, you know, from industrial farming to small holdings in some countries. So the solutions will always be specific. But definitely here in Wisconsin, we have developed a solution that will prevent the cranes from eating those corn seeds as they're germinating. And right now, the hope is, the focus of this committee is maybe how to get those solutions to the farmers effectively, more affordably for them. And so, the lessons learned from cranes and crop damage here in Wisconsin, we hope to apply to the upper Midwest and globally.
Well, I can't leave that hanging. And what is the solution you have in mind?
Oh, the magic word is we have worked for over 20 years with a company called Archean Life Science, and they have developed a preventative to keep birds from taking seed. It's a anthraquinone is a chemical that plants create themselves to make it so that they don't take seed before it's ripe. So they developed a seed treatment for corn in this case, that is a bittering agent essentially. And so if you treat your corn seed with that, it lasts the lifetime of that seed in the ground. and it prevents the cranes from taking a lot of it. They do need to test a seed or two to make sure that it is there and to know that they don't like it. But then they stay in the fields and they eat other things because they are omnivores. So we think that this seed treatment is very effective at preventing sandhill depredation, but we need extra assistance to make sure that farmers are aware of it, can afford it, and can take that extra step to treat their seed.
And Rick, absent that seed treatment, before that's in farmers' hands, like, are there tools? What kind of things are farmers able to do, trying to do to protect their crops from cranes, and I imagine other birds at the moment?
You know, without the treatment on the seed, we essentially have very limited options. Farmers can apply for depredation tags through the USDA, but as far as without the treatment, you can try to scare them off the field, try to distract them, that kind of thing. But we're very limited options without the treatment.
We're talking to two members of the Joint Legislative Council Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes. It's working to study crane management. Sandhill crane numbers, as we heard, up from a very, very dangerously low level, recovered in large part now. Ann Lacey is the International Crane Foundation Director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America. Rick Gerke, farmer and board member of the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association. And hovering behind all of this right now is the idea of a sandhill crane hunt, floated in the legislature a few years back. Having been in the media for a long time, I'll say nothing in Wisconsin is as controversial as the sentence, "We should hunt fill-in species here." What are your thoughts on the possibility of some kind of sandhill crane hunt?
Well, we have thoughts. It has come up a lot. And of course, in the hunting community, there is support for it. Likewise, if we polled our constituency, our membership, they would say we absolutely do not want one. So that is why we went to the University of Wisconsin Survey Center and had them do a stratified survey of the state of Wisconsin to really get kind of a better picture of what the state of Wisconsin wants as in regards to a sandhill crane hunting season. And it was pretty overwhelmingly that the answer was no, that we don't want that in the state of Wisconsin. Professionally, I definitely have a concern about hunting this species because of its ecology. Hunting it on its breeding grounds, not during the breeding season, of course, but depending on the timing of the season, we could over-harvest local breeding birds, which would definitely affect the population. So those are our concerns.
Rick, does your group take a position on the idea of a sandhill crane hunt in particular, or are you just kind of agnostic on that and looking for some kind of solution?
No, as Wisconsin corn growers, you know, we are in support of a sandhill crane hunt. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, looking at it, farmers are definitely conservations too. And I don't think there is a farmer out there that would like the population definitely decimated by any means. But I think we are definitely in support of a season as long as it is managed correctly.
And Rick, that idea of this treated seed making it more popular, available and affordable for farmers, does that seem like a potential solution, or at least part of the solution, as Ann was talking about earlier?
Yeah, I think it's a piece of the puzzle. You know, as a farmer, I definitely have more questions about it, you know, from a long-term aspect. You know, is this a short-term solution or what are the long-term effects of having that seed treatment on the seed in the ground? So there's a lot of different things we don't know yet that I think are getting researched or looked at a little better and looking for those results.
And I want to talk about the process here a little bit. We've got this committee, you know, committee's not famous for coming up quick solutions that everybody loves. That said, do you think this is a good approach, bringing different stakeholders and interests to the table together to try to come up with ideas?
Oh, absolutely. It's the perfect venue to get our information, our concerns out there, hearing the concerns and the thoughts of all these other groups, talking about them all around the table. Rick, we do have that information on Avapel specifically, on the effectiveness of it and, you know, does it affect the corn? Does it affect soil health? Things like that. So this is the perfect opportunity to get all of the information that we have together in one place to talk about it and to really work together moving forward to get these solutions to farmers.
And Rick, what are your hopes for an outcome from this committee?
You know, just being open-minded, and, you know, all coming together, you know, like Ann said, and hearing from all aspects or from all avenues of the group, and hopefully just come together and make a, get a solution done.
And based on, you know, one meeting so far on Thursday, do you think there's a road to get there that you and Rick and lawmakers and everybody can come up with a solution that's going to be at least palatable to all parties concerned?
Well, we've only scratched the surface. We do have four more meetings. And so there was a lot. The three presentations that we had on Thursday, we just, you know, talked about, you know, population levels and productivity of the sandhills in our state and the fact that they may be at carrying capacity. So now we can go on to the next meetings and talk about our field work with the effectiveness of these seed treatments and other potential solutions. And then we can go on to what management effect, management actions might affect the population. So we can continue these conversations and add more information to the mix.
And Rick, just briefly, you know, corn growers have a lot on their minds: drought last year, floods this year, international trade, list goes on. How high is the volume? How high on the list is the concern about sandhills right now?
It's definitely, you know, at the forefront, and I think it is a growing problem every year as the population tends to keep growing. So it's definitely another click in the belt, for say, of the issues that farmers are struggling with every year.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Ann, thanks for being with us.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Been talking to Ann Lacy, International Crane Foundation's Director of Eastern Flyway Programs North America, and Rick Gerke, farmer, board member of the Wisconsin Corn Growers Association. They're both members of the new Joint Legislative Council Study Committee on Sandhill Cranes. Got more reporting on that, some of the finer points of hunting laws at the federal level. Find that at WPR.org.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, a look at book challenges and bans in Wisconsin school libraries and the impact of these emotional debates on school staff.
They felt demonized. They still do. I've talked to so many librarians who've been doxxed, who've been attacked by community members.
That's coming up here on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Book bans and challenges at public schools are on the rise across the country. A recent report from PEN America found that Wisconsin was the second leading state in the number of book removals last school year.
And a new investigation from Wisconsin Watch found that more than 100 Wisconsin school districts have fielded requests to remove books over the past 4 years.
School administrators and librarians say they're feeling the strain of this surge in book banning efforts. One out of every three teachers in Wisconsin, which includes librarians, is likely to leave the profession within 5 years. That's according to a workforce analysis report from last year. Taslin Magnuson is a program consultant with Freedom to Read at PEN America, where she researches and tracks book challenges in K-12 libraries. Taslin, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Now, the organization you work with, PEN America, found that, at least by one measure, Wisconsin was the second leading state for the number of book bans in school libraries last year. What are we seeing there? Why are we seeing that happening in Wisconsin?
We are actually seeing it. What's happening in Wisconsin mirrors what's happening across the country. In Wisconsin, a large portion of the total for last year was driven by one district, which had one mom challenge over 400 titles that were pulled off the shelf for 3 to 4 months while the school reviewed them all. And eventually a lot of them went back on the shelves, but kids were without books for 3 to 4 months.
I want to dig more into that point. People might hear, oh, we're seeing more books challenged or removed from shelves or whatever, and might think there's a lot of people in a lot of districts challenging a book here and there. It seems like at least many of these, including that example you just mentioned, it's kind of a in bulk, if you will, a lot of books being challenged by one or two people at a time.
Yes, one or two people can make a huge difference. There are smaller challenges across Wisconsin. A lot of it's happening in public libraries, but yes, bulk challenges and a few people are really pushing this crisis.
A crisis, you said. How much do you worry when you see books removed either temporarily or permanently from a school library?
I think it's important to remember when we're talking about kids in school libraries, like the difference of a month in the time of learning and capabilities of a kid is huge. So we might think for ourselves, having reduced access for a month to a book is fine. We can wait on the hold lines at libraries. That's no problem. But for a kid, the acceleration and the need for that book at that time is brief. And so when we pull tons of books off shelves to review them, we're keeping them out of the hands of kids who really need them at that moment in time. And 3 months later, they may not need that book.
What kind of books do we tend to see getting challenged in schools?
So at Pen America, we found that a vast majority of the books under fire across the country are books about LGBTQ voices and BIPOC voices. It is a disproportionate amount, the total amount published, and it is devastating to the authors and devastating to the small publishers of many of those titles.
Is there an argument to be made that, you know, there might be books with some material that for a particular age group shouldn't be there, and the community should have a venue to bring that up and say, hey, maybe this particular book isn't ready for kids at this level?
I'm really glad you asked me that, because there is that process already in place. In nearly every single school district across the state of Wisconsin, they have a challenge policy. And they are, any parent, and I've used it myself for my own daughter, can request an alternative assignment, can talk with the librarian, or talk with the school principal about the books that are available to their students. It's when we want to extend that to across multiple families based on one parent's feelings that it gets really difficult. And librarians are best equipped with the school system and with the superintendents and the educators to really assess what books should be available to kids in conversation with their community. That's why we have board meetings. That's why you have the opportunity to have conversations with board members and attend school board meetings and sort of weigh in as a community.
Now, when I hear these talked about publicly, people challenging these books will often, you know, pull a particular excerpt that on its own may sound, for example, sexually explicit. You've said elsewhere, we need to look at the context that these are occurring in. What kind of things do you hope people keep in mind?
I think it's really important to read the entirety of a book. There is sexual content in some of the titles that have been challenged. That's absolutely true. But these are titles that are YA, so really designed for 14 to 18-year-olds and written specifically for them. And sexual content can be appropriate, but it's in the context of a plot. It's in the context of education. It's in the context of what's happening in that particular story.
What do you hear from school librarians themselves about the apparent uptick in book challenges?
It's funny. When I started doing this, I just was doing it because it was something that was helping friends of mine and supporting their work. But I started to put out my spreadsheet online, and librarians started to talk to me, and they said, I didn't know this was happening elsewhere. I didn't know that I wasn't alone. People are, they would call me and they would cry. Sometimes they would cry a lot because they had no place to turn. They felt overwhelmed. They felt demonized. They still do. I've talked to so many librarians who've been doxxed, who've been attacked by community members that they've been a part of this community for 20 years, and they're called groomers or sexual predators. And it's utterly devastating for them.
In talking to school librarians, have you gotten words of advice for others who might be facing these bulk challenges in particular that go beyond that regular challenge process?
Yeah, they've, as I've talked to lots of librarians, they've come down with sort of some key pieces of advice. Number one, like once the challenges come, there's no way through but through. So following your policies and procedures, working with your admin team, working with your school board, and talking about the importance of reading books in their full context and evaluating them according to established procedures, that is the best route. It takes time. It's really hard. But when you do that and you work through that, not only does the right answer for the community come through because everybody's participated in the conversation, but usually the community gets a better look into what goes into picking books for a school library. So then the other thing that they say is that to remain calm, that there's lots of name calling that can happen. There's lots of heightened emotional experiences. And the very best thing that you can do is prepare yourself for some people who are going to be really upset and just listen. Be calm and clear and consistent that you are an educator, you're a professional, and here are the established policies and procedures for that librarians follow to go through these questions.
It sounds like transparency is part of the story then, that showing here's what we do with your challenge, here's the process we go through, here's how these decisions are made, just having that be as public-facing as possible.
Yeah, I worked with a Western Wisconsin district last year, and they had a very tense situation where there were a number of very upset parents. And they, I was like, you know, the very best thing you can do right now is put a schedule online. And so create a schedule of the book challenges, when you expect to have them heard, and schedule it out. I said, remind everybody that librarians and educators have jobs outside of responding to mass challenges. So schedule it out as far as that you need to go. And I think she scheduled it out through the end of 2025. And it's not that things didn't stop happening in that district, but it took the temperature down. And I think that's really an important lesson, that providing all the information, people are very worried. Like, a lot of these complaints and concerns come from a place of real fear and worry for one's kids. And the very best thing that you can do is remember that these are also worried parents who need support. And so policies and procedures exist for a reason. And librarians that follow them, as hard as that is, and work with their admin team to do that, and don't respond to like the drama of it all, they get through the crisis in their district.
We're talking to Taslin Magnuson, Wisconsin-based program consultant for PEN America, about book challenges, book removals, temporary or permanent, at K-12 school libraries. Taslin, let's flip things around now to that parent. They see something or hear about something in a book. They find out it is, in fact, at their school library. They think it's not appropriate for their kid, kids of that age in general. They want to bring this forward. They don't feel like they're the bad guy here. What would you recommend for them to take that, again, without raising the temperature, but to raise their concerns and have them addressed?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is I would have a conversation either with that classroom teacher where that book might be, or have a conversation with their librarian. What I hear from so many librarians is that nobody's talking to them. They're going right to sort of these public comment periods at school board meetings. And librarians would love to talk to you about their processes for collecting material for schools. And then from there, you can also file formal reconsideration if that's what you, if you feel like you haven't gotten the right response or what feels right to you from the librarian in formal conversation, you can move to a reconsideration. And there's a policy and a procedure that's set out. Usually it's in your board policy manual that will explain how this works. And then just be prepared that it will take time, because reviewing a book that has been in the school library takes, you know, anywhere from several weeks to sometimes a month or two for a committee of community members and educators to gather together and talk about the book and what it's neat, what's the pros and the cons of it being as a part of the collection.
You co-wrote a piece for PEN America looking at some of the political background behind these challenges and the parental rights movement, it's called, in Wisconsin and elsewhere. What have we been seeing when it comes to this idea of parental rights, when it comes to these book challenges in the state?
So a lot of times parental rights means some parents, but not all parents. And it's difficult because it's all tied up with parents who, like I said, have a really deep, legitimate concern for their kids. But we also see funding by different political parties. We see lists created at a national and then sometimes a local level sent to politicians. And there usually includes some of those excerpts that you talked about that are the sexually explicit possible content from different titles. And so we see activation around the idea of parental rights, but it's not all parents. For example, like I for sure would love a diverse and inclusive collection of literature and LGBTQ voices to be in my town and my school library. And I want to be heard just as much as the parent who is worried about having that material for their kid. And so I really feel like the parental rights movement is sort of in a disguise for other cultural war issues that we have going on across the country.
And for that parent in a community where they're seeing other parents challenge books that they think should be included in the schools, that they think kids should have access to, do you have thoughts on how they can advocate, again, without necessarily raising that temperature of the argument?
I think the first thing that they want to do is make sure that their librarians and their school administrators know how much they appreciate the diverse collections that they might have already. Like many librarians have worked really hard across the state of Wisconsin to shape their collections that serve kids who are going to go out into a diverse world. And they've done an amazing job with the resources and the experiences that they have. So thank them for the collections that exist. Tell them how much they matter to you. And then if you have something starting to blow up in your community, remember that most people don't like book bans. Most people don't like what's happening. And your very best answer is to speak up at a school board meeting. And you don't need to answer any of the explicit readings or any of the other things that are happening. You just need to talk about why public education and why your school library matters to your family. And what we're trying to do when we do that is take the temperature down a little bit and remind everyone that there are parents who are across the spectrum politically, across the spectrum culturally, and that you're there and you're standing in support of your public schools.
Are you in touch with the authors themselves whose books are frequently challenged?
I am. I started this whole process not because I'm not a librarian. I usually say that much earlier in a conversation, but I'm not a librarian and I'm not an educator. I am actually have a MFA in writing for children and young adults. And so I came at this because I was seeing my friends talk about this and I was seeing people that I knew and people, authors that I had learned about. And they, Lori Hall Sanderson, who wrote Speak, she said, I'm getting banned a lot more than usual in 2021. And she said, someone should keep track. And I was like, well, Lori Hall Sanderson asked, I can do that. I know how to use a Google spreadsheet. And so that's how I got started in doing it. And so I gradually learned that most authors don't know when they're banned unless they are contacted by students or teachers or parents in the district in which they're being challenged, because they wouldn't have any reason to know. And so what they were also experiencing was a widespread request by folks to come help them, come help save their books. And authors are doing amazing things, and they've created an organization called Authors Against Book Bans that is doing great work in supporting communities across the country.
Now, here we are in a presidential election year. You're still tracking book challenges, book bans. What do you have your eye on as we go into another school year with a lot of politics out there?
Unfortunately, I don't think it's going to get any easier. We have a little bit more to go here. This is an issue that's like a match in a community. Once it starts, it sort of lights a lot of things on fire, and it takes a little while to calm down. And I expect that to continue. I mean, luckily, I think more and more folks across Wisconsin are getting engaged and involved in their local school boards. And so they're coming and they're listening to the school board work, which is extensive across every community.
Taslin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Taslin Magnuson is a program consultant with Freedom to Read at PEN America. Has this been an issue in your community? Want to hear from you, whether you're involved as an educator, a parent, a student, school board member, community member. Have you gotten involved in this issue? Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. to share your story in your community.
Still ahead on Wisconsin Today, an Altoona couple makes it their mission to camp in all the state parks, and they find park staff go the extra mile in caring and upkeep.
Think of hundreds of acres with playgrounds and beaches and big fields, and then all those hiking trails.
Pitching a tent all over Wisconsin, that's up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. For his 70th birthday, Dave Rowe of Altoona asked his wife to join him on a quest. Camp in every Wisconsin State Park campground.
She loved the idea. In 2021, they set off on their Wisconsin State Parks quest. Dave documented their adventures in a blog.
They completed that mission last year, and they join us now to talk about it. Sue and Dave, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Hello. Thanks for putting us on.
Dave, in the blog, you write about how the first part of the goal is to live long enough. And I know you had to process a lot of questions as to whether the two of you in your retirement years could accomplish camping at dozens of parks. What concerns did you have?
Well, you know, yeah, I did have concerns. I did have heart problems. I continue to have heart problems. But my philosophy is we decided, okay, we wanted to do these parks, 37 of them. Let's get started, do what we can. And once we got going and we realized, you know, how fantastic they are, you know, we did it in 3 years. So we're very proud of that.
Okay, Sue, so what was your reaction to this idea to camp in all of these campgrounds?
I'm pretty much up for an adventure most of the time, and I usually go along with Dave's various goals or schemes that he comes up with. So yeah, it just sounded like I thought, well, that sounds like fun. You know, we can go to these different places, and I hadn't realized, I think, how few we had actually been to. And so for me, the revelation was just how much I enjoyed the whole process of doing it.
What I love about this adventure is how you document, and the observations to me are just so wonderful. Like, primitive is fine. A hot shower after a day of hiking is more fine. I mean, it's really, you know, you put it out there. And I'm wondering, Dave, how did you go about writing this blog?
Well, it started saying, okay, I want to document it. And I didn't know anything about blogs, but I wanted to do that. And basically what I did was at almost every night, you got done, you're back in the tent, you're back in the camper. And I would sit down with a three-ring binder and just put down my random thoughts. I always try to put some things about that particular camp, state park. So there's some information on it. And the rest was, well, just me kind of coming off the top of my head with these are my reactions.
And Sue, what did you contribute to these observations and these reactions as you went from one campground to the next?
I think I had a pretty supportive role just when it comes to the blog part. This was kind of his deal. My contribution was, hey, I'll go along with you and I'll look around and I'll kind of say, you know, I'm a lot of times our travel planner when we do traveling. You know, I'm the one that makes reservations. I'm the one that, you know, looks up what to do. Dave likes to be surprised, you know, so I'd be the one going and looking ahead at what there was to do at locations we would be traveling to. And then I have to convince him, no, you really will like this. Just trust me. But so my job was kind of some of the planning, like, oh, if we're going to camp in this area, are there bike trails near there? So is it worth taking our bikes along, you know, to put them in the camper and take them along? Or is this going to be mostly hiking? Or, you know, how are we going to organize this as far as what we do when we're there? You know, I'm the one who likes to have the trail map in my pocket all the time.
I'll give her more credit than that. Sue is really the organizer. When I started, I thought this is going to take 5 years to do it. And Sue really took over, as I said, the organizing. So all of a sudden you look and say, you know what? We can do Devil's Lake, Mirror Lake, and Rocky Arbor back to back to back and knock off three of them at a time. This is one night. So Sue is really the one that pulled it all together. And that's how we got it done in 3 years.
Well, speaking of the organizing aspect of it, I mean, you mentioned Devil's Lake State Park. How far ahead did you have to plan to camp in the more popular parks?
Usually we started, you know, sometime around Christmas time, don't you think so?
Yeah. Usually in January you were making reservations. And then there's little tricks to it. So for example, if you reserve before May, you have to reserve for a minimum of 2 nights. And our goal was to just spend one night in each campground. So Dave would reserve Monday night and Tuesday night at one, and then he would reserve in my name Tuesday night and Wednesday night at the next one. And then we'd reserve Wednesday and, you know, so, and then we would just call before we got there and say, hey, we're going to cancel our second night, you know, kind of a thing. And there was a slight fee for that, but, you know, and then after there's sometime in May after that, then you can reserve just single nights. But some of them, like, so for example, Peninsula and Door County, Devil's Lake, two really popular campgrounds. Yeah, you do have to start early. And if you were a family and wanted to stay for, you know, 3-4 days with kids and stuff like that, and not be running around so much, you'd have to start really early because they book up really fast. We were lucky because we were just looking for one night. And so we could usually find a single night in the ballpark of when we were looking. But if you want to stay longer, yeah, you really have to start ahead of time. And to make ours all fit together, sometimes you had to go with the most popular campground, find your one night, and then fit the others around that.
You were really piecing it together. You know, there's the levels of roughing it. You know, you've got some tents, you've got the van life, the RV type of camping. What was your camping style of choice, Dave?
Well, you know, we started out, and we've done a lot of hiking and camping over the years. So we started at Merrick, and that was May 3rd, and it was cold. And at my age, you get out of the tent at least a couple times. And I won't go into details. But then we started saying, well, this is going to be tough to do the next 36. And that's where I say we went to the dark side. We started looking for campers, and we bought a camper that really has made a big difference comfort-wise and carrying everything. So we still tented some of them. Some of them are Rock Island, which is a great place. You know, you have to tent it. That's all you have out there in Lake Michigan. But so we kind of mixed it up. So that made it much easier to have a camper or an RV along.
Yeah, there's something about the sound of the rain beating on the roof of the camper that's much more musical than the sound of rain beating on your tent. I'm just going to say that. And although, you know, he didn't really want to mess with pulling the camper on and off the ferry, like going to Madeline Island. So we did Madeline Island and Copper Falls back to back. And so those we just tented at. And it did rain in Copper Falls. So right about the time it was going to start to rain, we would go out to eat somewhere nearby for supper. And when we pulled into Copper Falls, we're like, well, where's a good place to eat nearby? And she was like, well, it's 25 miles to Ashland, and it's 30 miles to go to Iron Mountain or Iron River, whatever was in Michigan. And we're like, whoa, okay. Well, then as it started to, you know, they kept pushing off the rain. So the rain didn't end up starting, fortunately, until about 4 p.m. But we just drove to Ashland, went and hung out in the library for a couple hours till it closed, then went to the restaurant and had supper, and then drove back. And then by that time, it's like, okay, we can turn in, read in the tent. And it's not like we were like trapped in our tent for hours because of the rain. So
you made it work.
Pretty fortunate. And yeah, the most rustic was, you know, because you really did have to backpack for both Newport and for Rock Island.
We're talking about Wisconsin State Park campgrounds. We have Dave and Sue Rowe and their quest. They stayed in all 37 state park campgrounds between 2021 and 2023. You know, flexibility has multiple definitions, but I'm just wondering, how do you hike trails with confidence in getting up in age and, you know, trying not to have concerns about slipping or tripping in any aspect of camping?
Good common sense. I mean, carry enough water, you know, make sure you're dressed for whatever it is you're doing, you know, layer up, layer down. I mean, you take layers with you. I'm always amazed any place I've been in the country where you see people who are just so incredibly unprepared, you know, good footwear. I mean, when I see people, I mean, we rafted the Grand Canyon, and it always just slayed me that all of our guides would go hiking on these rough trails and they all wore flip-flops. And I was just like, oh my gosh, that just looks like an accident waiting to happen. But they were all very sure-footed, of course. But I mean, really good hiking footwear, you know, carry
good
water
poles
with you. We use hiking poles. I've got bad knees. I've got one that's been replaced, but I've had a number of arthroscopies over the years, and I have knee braces that I wear depending on how strenuous the hiking is. But using the poles, and somebody said, well, how do those help you? I said, well, they help me going up and they help me going down. Mm-hmm. So I mean, you know, and they're not a huge investment. But yeah, and paying attention to the weather. I mean, sometimes there are. And the state parks do a great job, just a really great job. Every state park has maps of their trails. They tell you how long they are. A lot of them will have a description telling you how strenuous the hike is. So you can kind of pick and choose the hikes that will get you where you want, you know, that will sort of fit where you're at. And, you know, and unfortunately, some of the best views you have to earn, you know, yeah. I mean, if you go to Buckthorn, they have a little observation tower, but it's only 16 steps up because it's a pretty prairie area. And then the next day we went to Roche de Cree, which was, I think, 300 steps to get up to the top of the rock formation up there. Mill Bluff's the same way. You have to go up a whole bunch of steps if you're gonna, you know, get the view. Devil's Lake, I mean, great views from up by Balancing Rock and Devil's Doorway. But boy, you earn it because you're going up kind of stones that are kind of like steps but it's up, you know.
Yeah,
so
so
some of the best views you do have to kind of earn, but at the same time, there's always some satisfaction in knowing you're seeing something that not everybody can see because they don't put in the effort. So, and pace yourself. That's the other thing I would say. You pace yourself, you know. And that makes a big difference.
Sue, you made a great list there. Dave, do you have anything else you want to add to that list?
Well, not so much a list, just a comment. Sue mentioned the staff and so on. And the state parks, we're just, they're tremendous people. I mean, I can barely keep my backyard all mowed and nice. And think of hundreds of acres with playgrounds and beaches and big fields, and then all those hiking trails, and then answering any questions. And boy, we've got a great state staff. We're very lucky. We're impressed everywhere we went. And then volunteer groups in many of the larger state parks, that without them, it wouldn't be the high quality that they have. So, you know, I got to give kudos to how these are kept up and maintained and run just above everything.
You are always in good company with people who love the outdoors as much as you do, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. And people are friendly. You know, in campgrounds, by and large, people are friendly. And yeah, you know, and there's various kinds of camping. Dave prefers a campsite where you don't see any of your neighbors, you know, and some of them are like that. Some of them aren't, you know. I thought Devil's Lake was fine, but he kind of felt like you could look out over the field in front of you and, you know, see 100 other campers or whatever.
Well, I'm so curious. What have you been up to this summer?
Staying alive. I'm only partially kidding. We actually had planned this summer. David said, well, what do we do now? And I'm like, why don't we actually go back to places that we really liked and spend, two or three nights there and just really enjoy the area and not be quite, because it, you know, I mean, we were really comfortable and we had our routine down, but it was like, get there, set up, hike, do whatever, you know, next morning, maybe we'd hike or bike or do something else. And then it's like, okay, you know, pack it up, take it down, haul it to the next one, set it up, do what you're going to do, you know, and sometimes we did that 3-4 days in a row. And there were times I was like, oh, there's so much more here that we didn't get to, or there's, you know, it's a really pretty area and I could just stay and enjoy it longer. So our plan was to go back and camp more. And we did do that at Willow River, where we did go over and spent a couple nights there. And,
on July 3rd, I collapsed, my heart stopped. I had to be shocked back alive.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Which they did, and I'm doing okay and recovering. So it kind of put a little bit of the kibosh for the moment. I'm building up my strength again. So we didn't anticipate me dying. but here we are on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yeah, he's actually doing quite well, and we're very fortunate that he collapsed on a pickleball court where there were people nearby who knew CPR and there was an AED handy. So we'll take this opportunity on Wisconsin Today to say, hey, make sure you have AEDs handy in many public locations and recommend people get basic life support training because it can literally save lives. So we'll put that plug in too.
That took a turn you didn't anticipate.
That was not the ending I anticipated, but what a wonderful, wonderful time to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us and, you know, happy trails.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Happy camping, everybody. Happy camping.
Happy trails.
Dr. Sue and Dave Rowe live in Altoona in their adventures camping in all 37 of Wisconsin's state park campgrounds. They're documented in their blog called Wisconsin State Parks Quest.
It's an election year, if you hadn't noticed, and lately election season in the U.S. seems to come along with a high dose of anger.
Tomorrow, we'll hear from a Wisconsin psychologist known as the Anger Professor about the role of anger in our lives, how to rein it in, and how anger can sometimes be a positive force for change.
And we want to hear from you. Have you had angry conversations about politics with family, friends, coworkers, or maybe total strangers online? Has it affected your relationships? Have you found ways to get along in spite of the political differences?
Share your story. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Or you can connect with us, call or text at 888 888- 646-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.